Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
5. We're losing track of all the disgraced Tory MPs who are having to stand down, aren't we?
4.
I'm very worried. I think people are sleepwalking into allowing the most left-wing Labour government in history the opportunity to seize power.
Nigel Farage in the wings. Will he, won't he? That will have a big bearing on the upcoming general election.
I was a student protester, Halligan.
God, why doesn't that surprise me?
1. We have liftoff.
Welcome once again to Planet Normal, the Telegraph podcast with Alison Pearson.
Hello.
And me, Liam Halligan. So, no surprise that the Tories got hammered in last week's local elections across England, Alison. But perhaps they didn't do as badly as some thought. Let's see what Velma thinks. No pressure. Is the plot to oust Rishi Sunak now over? Or could rebel Tory MPs, concerned that the Prime Minister isn't conservative enough, still move against him before a general election expected this autumn? Sunak's immediate attempts to rebuild post-local election party morale have been shattered by the defection of Dover MP Natalie Elphick to Labour just a fortnight after another Tory, Dan Poulter, Central Suffolk and North Ipswich MP, also crossed the floor. Ben Houcher remains Tees Valley's mayor, a rare Tory gain, but Reform didn't stand against him. But Reform did stand a candidate for West Midlands mayor, which led to the ousting by a whisker of Tory incumbent Andy Street. Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves meanwhile accuses ministers of gaslighting the public when it comes to the economy. The UK is pulling out of recession and interest rates are set to fall, bringing relief to mortgage holders and indebted firms. But any claims the cost of living crisis is over would serve only to show, in Reeves' words, how out of touch the Tories are with the realities of ordinary people's lives. And what does gaslighting mean anyway, co-pilot? I've heard my kids use it a few times, but I've never really understood it. Before we get going, let's quickly remind listeners of our Planet Normal event. Hooray! On Wednesday, the 29th of May at Cadogan Hall in central London, a live recording of our 200th episode. How exciting! More details at the end of the show. But let's start, Alison, by reflecting first on recent student protests against Israeli assaults on Gaza seen in Oxford, Cambridge, and various other UK universities. Copycat demos following some pretty serious unrest on campuses across the US. Were you a firebrand student protester, Alison? Did you wield banners while wearing monkey boots amidst the dreaming spires?
I think it was Frederick Raphael who wrote that rather good novel about Oxbridge or Cambridge, and he described it, not the city. He said Oxford was the city of dreaming spires and Cambridge was the city of perspiring dreams. Anyone who knows his work would know that was typical of his rather clever wordplay. I was a student protester, Halligan.
Oh, God, why doesn't that surprise me? You must have been insufferable. God.
Well, not much shame.
Dungarees? Did you have the dungarees on?
Yes, green dungarees. How many times have I got to tell you, Halligan, that my cyclist against the bomb badge was single-handedly responsible for Gorbachev introducing glasnost? As we know, we cyclists against the bomb don't get enough recognition for our part in the fall of the Berlin Wall.
In the history of geopolitical thought.
I think each generation probably thinks their protest is more interesting and valid, don't they? I mean, I look at these kids now. They're camping in exactly the same spot where I sat in a cage for Amnesty International on the narrow strip of grass outside King's College, Cambridge. I think I sat in there for several hours, got quite a damp bum, but ended up on the front page of the student newspaper, which was called Stop Press. We were anti-apartheid in those days, Liam.
So you were damp bums against apartheid.
I certainly was. And Nelson Mandela was, of course, hugely grateful for my contribution. There was a very funny story about my beloved partner in life, who, as you know, Liam, is not political at all. And we did overlap briefly at Cambridge as students, but fortunately I never met him because I was in my northern cagoule scowling phase and he was in his four-piece tweed T.S. Eliot memorial suit. So it was very lucky that we didn't meet. But I did say to him once that I had picketed Barclays Bank, which was South African, of course, Barclays, and was heavily bound up as we saw it in the evil apartheid regime. And Anthony said perkily, "Oh, I opened an account at Barclays Bank in that year." So probably the first words I exchanged with him were "fascist scum."
Out.
Yeah, exactly. But just to say, I mean, look, as you said, it's copycat protest, isn't it, from the rather unpleasant campus protest in the States.
What would your sloganeering be now? What do we want? Kitten-heeled fuchsia mules. When do we want them? Now.
No, I want to stop illegal migration, as you know, which I'd certainly go on a demo for that. But these kids now, and I think that you can see them all with their masks.
The black and white ones, yeah, that have long been associated with the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization.
It was a sort of Yasser Arafat memorial, yeah, tea towel, isn't it, really? You know, I look on them slightly with despair because I think that the distinct anti-Semitic tinge to it. And look, they're right to be able to protest about what's going on in Gaza. Of course, thousands of people have tragically been killed after the horrendous Hamas massacres of October the 7th. But what gets me, Liam, I think, is that my lot all those decades ago were basically on the side of Western civilization. I'm not sure these kids are anymore. You know, I think they loathe the Western way of life, really, and they are anti-capitalist in a slightly lazy way, not realizing that all the nice money their mums and dads give them comes from capitalism. You know, I think they're a bit drippy, and there's a slight element of them job sharing between Extinction Rebellion and let's have a bit of anti-Gaza and let's go on the pro-Palestine marches. I'm not sure how much they understand what they're talking about, but I suppose you would have accused the 20-year-old Alison of much the same.
Not like it was in our day. God, we're getting old.
We are getting old.
Oh, my nerve ends. Oh, I said, oh, she said, oh.
I'll tell you what, though. I mean, laughing aside about my contribution to these great world events.
It must have been terrible, my God.
It was terrible.
I'm so pleased for Anthony that he didn't meet you there.
Yeah, I know.
Jumped him. You'd have got him in a half Nelson.
I would have lectured him. That's what I can't get now, is they're all lecturing us. They're all white and privileged and lecturing everybody else on white privilege, aren't they? But we have, look, change does come. We have seen the fall of apartheid, and we did indeed see the crumbling of the evil Soviet Empire. So
his bums were not dampened in vain.
That's enough.
Okay, we're in denial. Local elections. Yes. The Tories got hammered. Ben Houchen stayed mayor in the Tees Valley, though he didn't manage to wear a conservative rosette in his victory speech. Sadiq Khan, of course, won in London,
yeah,
against a creditable performance from Susan Hall, the Tory candidate, I must say. And Andy Street lost in the West Midlands, despite a lot of local popularity. And he lost, Alison, as you pointed out, because Reform stood against him, but Reform didn't stand against Ben Houchen.
No, that's right. In fact, it was a dreadful day and night, wasn't it, for the Conservatives? They actually managed to do even worse than the worst predictions. But yeah, I mean, of 11 mayoral places being contested, the Tories held only one, which was your mate, Ben Houchen, in Tees Valley. But he's built up a fabulous local personal brand, hasn't he? So he was sort of bomb-proof against the falling Conservative fortunes. I thought it was a great shame, actually, that Andy Street was deposed as mayor of the West Midlands, a guy with great business experience at John Lewis.
Joined as a trainee, ended up running the whole shebang. Pretty impressive. And I've reported from Birmingham a fair bit over recent years, interviewed Andy Street a couple of times. There is genuine local respect for him, not just among the population as a whole, though of course not enough this time round, but I sensed among even opposition councillors, other Labour local politicians. He did a good job in the West Midlands. And I think he will feel that loss. And I could see him coming back to Westminster, actually. I can see the Tories trying to find him a safe seat. if there is such a thing.
I've been saying that for about a year, banging on, no such thing as a Tory safe seat. But he did lose to some Labour guy who I didn't think looked particularly impressive with a very brief CV. And Andy Street lost. The Labour guy got 225,590 to 224,082. Mm. And that was clearly because Reform had stood and pinched those votes. And I understand.
And across an electorate of about 600 odd thousand, you know.
Yeah. But I think that going back to the general picture of these local elections, and there was this by-election in Blackpool South. We're losing track of all the disgraced Tory MPs who are having to stand down, aren't we, really? Can never remember whether this is the one who was lobbying, unfortunately, in Parliament for nefarious people.
We need to set up a situation room, like we're sort of investigating a massive crime, you know, people's photos on the wall with bits of thread strung between them.
And then in the centre, a picture of several Brazilian rent boys who link all the Marcuses and Riches. Oh, my God.
We're looking for a pattern here. I can't quite sense what it is. Who's going to win the election? Who's going to lose?
But as you said at the top, Liam, Velma, let's say we haven't heard of Velma for a while, have we?
No, you are Velma for new listeners. The geeky one out of Scooby-Doo. And I am, hello, hey, school. I'm Scooby and Shaggy.
You are Scooby and Shaggy. I always wanted to be Daphne, but I've ended up as Velma with the glasses and the spreadsheet. But so Blackpool South, quite a low turnout, which is what we've been seeing. This is the 11th by-election that the Tories will have lost in this parliament. But this is bearing out a theory that we've been exploring, haven't we, on the podcast. So Blackpool South, quite interesting, was a Conservative seat for 50 years after the war, and then Labour won it briefly, and then this Tory guy snatched it back in 2019. It didn't have a huge majority, about 3,500. So Labour did win Blackpool South last week with a vote of 10,825. That was a swing of 20%. And the Conservatives were 3,218, Liam. But Reform was very narrowly pipped to third with 3,101. So that was literally 117 votes away from Reform being in second place. And if they can start coming in second place, you know, in various constituencies, that is going to have a seismic effect. But I think the thing, this is where we get to the really nerdy nitty gritty, is that in the 2019 general election, the Tories won Blackpool South with 16,247 votes. So even if we assume that 3,000 of those votes this time at the by-election went to Reform, Liam, you've still got 10,000 former Conservative supporters in Blackpool South who stayed home, right? So this is the pattern now we're seeing, is that the Tory voter absolutely refusing to come out. And I don't see that changing. There was some talk about a hung parliament after the drubbing that the Tories got. I think that's absolutely ridiculous. I don't think there's any possibility that they will get close to a hung parliament. But what do you make of it? I mean, there are a lot of voters who will have to be persuaded back. And it doesn't look to me like Sunak's got the making of that, really.
I think it was obviously a terrible night for the Tories. And as Velma says, Reform stood in only a fifth of seats. Now, under Richard Tice with Nigel Farage in the wings, will he, won't he? That will have a big bearing on the upcoming general election, whether or not Nigel Farage returns to frontline politics in the UK ahead of the general election by spearheading Reform. I see quite a lot of Nigel Farage, of course, at GB News, and I genuinely think that he still doesn't know. He's at a point of maximum power now because everyone's wondering what he's going to do. But I think that's genuinely unknown at the moment. And I think also, while it was a terrible night for the Tories, Sunak has probably done enough for now to see off the plotters. There were people in the House of Commons who have been agitating to remove him. There's talk of letters going in to Sir Graham Brady. We'll hear more about that later in this episode when we talk to an influential Tory backbencher on the right of the party. There is this groundswell of opinion among MPs that Sunak simply hasn't been conservative enough and he needs to become more conservative. That's why, you know, he did some three announcements just before the local election, didn't he, on immigration and defence and on borders more generally. So I do think that plot for now is over. The question is, will it rear its ugly head again?
if there are more defections to Labour, if there are more by-elections for whatever reason. So can the Tories hold it together long enough for the economy to improve to a palpable degree so they can get some kind of bounce from the economy? Not enough to help them win, but at least enough to limit the landslide.
I don't think it's that Sunak's done enough to see off the plot. I think the plotters have just thrown their hands up in the air and decided there simply isn't enough time to get a new leader installed and to make the changes that would be necessary to convince the voters. I mean, I think that, you know, Robert Jenrick, former immigration minister, has just outlined a new plan for migration. And he has warned Rishi Sunak that Tory voters are on strike and that they need to be honest with the public about the mistakes of the past. But one cabinet minister said that Rishi needs to own his own shit. I don't think we are seeing a massive rallying round him, Liam. On the contrary, and of course, today, Wednesday, as we record Planet Normal, we have seen another defection, this time of the Conservative MP for Dover, Natalie Elphick. And this is very much now Operation SOS, Save Our Skins. Natalie took over as MP in Dover after her husband was involved in some sort of harassment allegations. And she says, she claims she is leaving the Conservatives because of the chaos. The country needs to move on from the broken promises of Rishi Sunak's tired and chaotic government. She says that it's moved too far from the centre ground. And she also said the two key factors, this is for Natalie Elphick, were housing and the safety and security of our borders. Well, I think we've got a bit of a shock for Natalie if she thinks that Labour is going to be any better with the security of our borders. In fact, there was a certain Natalie Elphick who you'll be amused to learn was a year ago said that she was very worried that Labour was out to defy the British people in their attempt to bring mass immigration under control. So Natalie has, bless her heart, has changed her mind. And who would claim it was because she could see the end of her career looming in the next 6 months?
The expectation is, from what she said, that she will stand down at the election and Labour will field another candidate. So maybe she's just trying to just, you know, stab the party that got her into power in Dover as she goes out the door, maybe to try and get herself some publicity for whatever reason. I don't know. But it is damaging, and I'm sure there will be more defections as the weeks go by, a kind of drip, drip by the Labour Party. I mean, will people end up with peerages?
Yeah.
Other kind of patronage? We just don't know. I think what's really important in terms of politics now is the economy. I was with Rachel Reeves earlier this week. She gave a speech in the City of London, and she's accusing ministers, the Tories, of gaslighting the British public over the economy. In other words, if there are improvements in the economic data, and there will be improvements tomorrow, Friday, the day after Planet Normal is released, because the GDP figures are almost certainly going to show, when they're published by the Office for National Statistics, that Britain has indeed pulled out of recession. We went into a very short, shallow recession in the last 6 months of 2023. But all the survey data now, and I'm sure the official GDP data will confirm we're out of that recession. Plus, the mood music from the Bank of England is that interest rates are going to be falling relatively soon. So there could be a sense that the economy's turned the corner. Labour's absolutely determined that the Tories aren't going to wring any kind of favour out of that by saying that if ministers try and claim the cost of living crisis is easing, then, quote, that shows how out of touch they are with the lives of ordinary British people. And it's true in the sense that a tiny little upturn and tax cuts, which don't help pensioners because they're national insurance cuts, and a relatively small, anyway, in the grand scheme of things, 900 quid a year, they're not really breaking through. And Labour are determined to turn the narrative against the Tories with the use of this term gaslighting. I mean, who even knows what it means? But I'm sure party strategists are happy because it's led to a discussion, and we're having one now on Planet Normal. What is this term, gaslighting?
I think I'm remembering this right. I think there was a novel or a play which was called Gaslighting. And I think the idea is that you, now we call it coercive control, don't we? You gaslight someone by making them, giving the impression that something is true when it clearly isn't, and kind of drive them mad, I think. So I think what Rachel Reeves is trying to say is that the Conservatives are gaslighting the voters by trying to make them think one thing about the economy when quite the other is true. But of course, Liam, we, you know, with our kids in their late teens and 20s, we're used to being told that we're, whatever it is, guilty of a microaggression.
Guilt tripping them, gaslighting them. I think gaslighting is basically what someone throws at you when you're trying to show them a contrary position and you're producing evidence, facts, solid reasoning, logic. Oh, you're gaslighting me, you're gaslighting
exactly,
me. I actually had a conversation with one of the Labour apparatus, if you like, at that Rachel Reeves speech about the term. And we discussed that it actually comes from a film, an Ingrid Bergman film in the early 1940s.
That's right, yes.
A kind of thriller mystery about a man who tries to drive his wife insane and she ends up having a nervous breakdown. But yeah, Labour have very deliberately used this term because they know it's a younger generation term and they know that lots of middle-aged hacks are going to have conversations like this. What's she even talking about? But, you know, Labour are now so electorally confident, they're into not rebuttal, but pre-buttal. That's the Blairite term. And I would not be surprised if the various Blairites surrounding the Labour leadership at the moment, not least one Lord Mandelson, who we know so well, is introducing these tactics because they proved so electorally effective in 1997. But this isn't 1997. That's the difference. That's the only hope that the Tories have got, because Labour's support is wide, but it is shallow. I don't think there's any way they can turn around this election, but I do think there's a lot that can happen between now and the country going to the polls, which looks increasingly as if it is going to be somewhere between mid-October and mid-November.
Well, Keir Starmer's punishing dullness has him on minus 31 satisfaction, which is marginally better than Rishi Sunak. But, we've said this, haven't we? There just isn't that sort of drumbeat of anticipation and excitement that there was in 1997 with some very impressive Blair, Brown, all those extraordinary people who were ready to come in. And actually, you know, talking about this thing about whether there would be a hung parliament. I mean, what these elections, the local elections, didn't even show us, Liam, is that there weren't any results in Scotland at all. So Labour would expect, with the SNP in its interesting transgender phase, probably set to lose 25 seats to Labour. In fact, the Lib Dems picked up more council seats than the Conservatives did. But the fact is, what's going to happen, I think, is we're going to see a lot of those votes for the Lib Dems and the Greens.
I mean, Wales, Labour have got like, there are 40-odd seats in Wales. Labour have got sort of 20-odd. And they're going to build on that, aren't they? So, as you say, Scotland and Wales not being in the local elections skewed the result away from Labour, because in Scotland and Wales, they're likely to do quite well.
My Wales is basically under the... They really are being gaslit. They are under the coercive control of the dreaded Drakeford.
Vaughan Gethin now. Vaughan Gethin. It's changed. Do keep up.
I do. No, I know who it
Velma's, is. Velma's specs are getting fogged up.
Moving from one uselessness to the next. But Rachel Reeves did say, Liam, this is forecast to be the first parliament on record with living standards actually lower at the end than at the start. Now, I guess we could point to the fact that we've had COVID and Ukraine and all sorts of major events to make that so, but that is still a pretty damning charge. And just to something I wrote about this week in my column, actually, was this phenomenon we've seen with lots of Muslim council candidates standing for the Greens. So we've got this bizarre alliance now where the Greens, which used to be, you know, save the otter.
Nice middle class people with bobs and knitted jumpers.
Completely sort of, you know, knit your own orgasm type of women, you know. And now we've got Mothin Ali, who won the Gipton and Harehills ward in Leeds for the Green Party. And he caused quite a stir. In fact, there were a large number of Muslims who did indeed take council seats on Gaza tickets. So you had this very, very strange spectacle of northern towns. Actually, the council seats were being fought over, you know, a conflict that was thousands of miles away. But Mohsin Ali caused a real row when he basically shook his fist in the air and said that his victory was a win for the people of Gaza, nothing about the poor people of East Leeds, who've got a few worries of their own. And then he sort of shouted, "We will raise the voice of Palestine, Allahu Akbar," which, as we know, Liam, is a highly contentious phrase often heard around terrorist acts. So I think this was, well, I was quite horrified watching his victory speech. We think of our politics as being mercifully secular. And what we were seeing in various of these wards was an aggressive and kind of pretty alien spectacle, which I think was showing that, confirming the failure of multiculturalism in our country, which is now breeding what could become a very toxic sectarian politics.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Today, we welcome Conservative MP Andrew Rossendale aboard the Rocket. Born and brought up in Romford, where Essex meets Greater London, Rossendale's represented the constituency of his birth since winning the seat in 2001. A committed Brexiteer, he was among the 28 Tory MPs who originally rebelled against Theresa May's Brexit withdrawal agreement in 2019. And while having served on his party's front bench in opposition, as a shadow Home Office Minister under David Cameron, Rossendale's made his name largely as an influential and courageous backbench campaigner. Who better, we thought, to take the mood of the parliamentary party in the aftermath of last week's local and mayoral elections, widely seen as a disaster for Rishi Sunak? Is the Tory backbench plot to oust the Prime Minister before the general elections really over? Could it be resurrected if Sunak fails to do what the rebels want, moving towards what they see as more traditional Conservative policies on tax, immigration and defence? I started by asking Andrew Rossendale for his reaction to his party's local election performance.
They're pretty disastrous, aren't they? It's really bad for the Conservative Party that we're now losing so much support from our core voters. And I think there's a lot of disappointment, there's disillusionment about the government, about the party. But I have to say, I think it's generally disillusionment about politics in this country. There's a feeling that not only that nothing works, but the people we vote for, the people we elect, don't really seem to have the power to do very much. Everything seems to be a process. Everything seems to be controlled by people we don't elect, civil servants and public bodies that seem to make their own decisions. And the actual people like myself who stand for election seem to have very little influence over what happens. And I think that's the root of our problem. And I think for the government to get back on track, we've got to show that we're in charge again.
Andrew, what do you say to those in your party, your fellow Conservative parliamentarians, who think the answer to your party's electoral woes is to go in the direction that you would feel is less Conservative?
Well, I think it's bonkers. I think the reason why we're losing votes is because we were elected on a clear Conservative mandate with an 80-seat majority, and we appear, certainly in the eyes of a large numbers of the public, that we haven't actually delivered on the things we said we would do. We've, in fact, gone in a very different direction. Now, a lot of that is, I'm afraid, to do with the consequences of lockdowns. And I think we need to talk about this a bit more, because I think the lockdowns did huge long-term damage to our country, to our economy, to the mindset of the British people. And we're suffering the consequences of that. And a lot of the problems we're facing today are throwback from that period when I think personally, foolishly, we locked down the country for 2 years on and off. And I think there are consequences to pay for that. However, I actually think the period of the pandemic and the lockdowns could have been an opportunity for the government to actually reduce layers of government. For instance, a good example of that would have been the Greater London Authority. I think the mayor should have been stripped of his control over TfL. I don't think we should have allowed the Scottish and Welsh First Ministers to have power. It should have been a UK-wide matter. So a lot of it, I'm afraid, dates back to the lockdowns. We're suffering from the consequences of that. But the party and the government has lost its radical edge. If we want to win the next election, we have to deserve it. And to deserve it, we've got to show we've got a vision for the country. And a vision for the country needs clear, strong leadership. And Rishi Sunak has a window of opportunity now to show that he understands what the country needs and to get on with the job. If he doesn't, I think we've got big problems coming down the road later in the autumn.
You genuinely think that the UK's experience of lockdown, because so much of the public did give up freedoms, because we did become more statist, because a lot of families were entirely reliant on government handouts, so-called furlough, do you think that's made the country systematically less conservative?
It's taken people's eye off the ball. I believe that Britain and any country, of course, can be strong and prosperous and successful, but it's down to the people themselves. Governments can't make the country successful. They can provide leadership, they can provide structure, they can provide sensible laws. Unfortunately, we've got into the mindset where the people are now just depending on the government to solve every problem and fix every issue. Equally so, we've spent huge sums of money. What is it, Liam? You know better than me. $400 to $500 billion we've borrowed to pay for the pandemic. Well, you know, that money wasn't free and it has to be paid back. And there are consequences to borrowing large sums of money. We now have huge, huge levels of taxation, which is deeply unconservative and clearly is not going to lead to a vibrant, competitive economic situation with such high levels of taxes. So we do need to get back to being a bit more radical, to give people more freedom with responsibility. And that, I think, is what we're missing at the moment. We've got plenty of things that need doing, but the government can't do all of it. Reduce the size of government. There's too much government, too much interference, too much red tape and bureaucracy and quangos making decisions. It needs a 1979 moment. You know, that's what's required. 1979, Margaret Thatcher came in with a clear agenda for Britain, and it was tough. It was unpopular to start with. This is what Liz Truss tried to do to some extent. But ultimately, if you stick at that kind of plan for a country, you reap rewards down the road. And that's the kind of radical approach I believe my party needs to now adopt.
You're a small state kind of chap, Andrew. You're a very pro-enterprise MP. You want a competent state, but you don't like the idea that the tax burden is at a 70-year high, taxes a share of our national income. What would you say to politicians, even journalists, broadcasters, who say that your views are not just centre-right, but a hard right, a far right?
No, they're the absolute opposite of that. I think that I represent, in many of my views, I know people will brand me in that way, but it's completely wrong. I represent the common ground. I think that most people want to see small government. They don't like government interfering in their lives. Look at the latest thing the government tried to do at the moment, ban the smoking. I mean, we all want kids to not smoke. Of course we do. But banning things and taking away people's freedom is not the way to do it. So I think that we do need a small state. And I do think that most people don't like overbearing government, high taxes, bureaucracy, and red tape. They do want to see their town halls and their government town halls and their government departments open for business and civil servants and local government officers back to work. They do want to see things returning to normal. But equally so, we need government to have a vision for this. Unfortunately, we're still bobbing along the bottom. We haven't quite got out of that lockdown mindset. And I think that in the next 6 months, and we only have maximum of 6 months left. Well, I suppose we could go to January, but I would imagine it's going to be maximum of 6 months. the Conservative Party has a chance. It has a chance to show that we've got a vision for the country which will get Britain back on track. That is what's needed. I don't think Labour have any ideas that are better than ours. In fact, I think in many areas, they have no ideas at all. They have no concept of what needs to happen. It seems to me they want to be in government for the sake of being in government, to kick us out so that they can be in instead. They don't really have a clear idea of what the country needs. I think the Conservative Party still has that ability. It still has that possibility that we can show strong leadership again, but we are running out of time.
So let's cut to the chase, Andrew Rossendale. You're not just an observer in this debate. You're a player. You are one of the backbench MPs who could very easily hand in a letter to your friend Sir Graham Brady. Maybe you even have. He only needs to receive 52 letters, then we're in no confidence territory. And yet you're talking about Sunak having a window of opportunity. Is the plot to remove the Prime Minister before a general election resting, or is it over?
Well, I'm not involved in any plot. I haven't sent a letter into Sir Graham Brady, and I have been speaking to the Prime Minister. I've never actually put a letter in against any Prime Minister. You know, I'm very much committed to the party coming together and for us to win the next election unified. But look, we all know that there are times when changes have to happen in order to win. That happened 5 years ago when Theresa May stood down and Boris Johnson came in, and things were turned around within 5 or 6 months. So I'm not saying that's going to happen again, but I do think Rishi needs to think long and hard about where we're going. You know, he has done everything he possibly can to get us into a better economic state, and it's very slow, but we are gradually getting into a better economic position. But is it going to be enough for us to win the election? He needs to think long and hard about where we're going. I think by the Whitsun recess, we either need a very clear, strong agenda for Britain, where the British people can actually think again and stop a left-wing Labour government from being elected, give them the opportunity to vote for something clear and positive, which is going to put the country back on track. And if Rishi isn't going to do that, then clearly, you know, the party and Rishi are going to have to think again. So I am confident that in the next few weeks, the party is going to come together and there's going to be a clear new approach. We cannot go on as we are. We need to refresh the government. We need clear, strong, radical policies. He needs to bring people back who have been pushed out. You know, it's no good having a government of technocrats, government of administrators. We need a government with a strong conservative vision for Britain.
The weather's getting better. The number of small boat crossings are likely to go up. Already so far this year, on the latest numbers, there have been more crossings than in 2023. Andrew, do you think the UK needs to leave the ECHR in order effectively to tackle the small boats crisis? Or do you think we can do it from within the ECR framework, maybe with derogations or clauses that we can insert for our own domestic purposes? Because this really has become the litmus test for many Conservatives, hasn't it, of whether or not Rishi Sunak is serious about tackling this crisis?
I doubt whether we can do that before the election. I think there's lots of things I'd like the party to adopt as policy to try to get them through before the election, but I don't think we can, because within the parliamentary party, there wouldn't be a majority for it. But we have to be radical, and we have to stop worrying about what everyone else is going to think about what we do. Start thinking about what's in the interest of Britain. And it's clearly in the interests of the United Kingdom that we are sovereign in our own land. Now, we left the European Union for that purpose, but we forgot about the ECHR, which now has far too much power, disproportionate power over what happens. Now, this is Labour's fault, of course. It was Tony Blair that brought in the Human Rights Act, which embedded the ECHR into British law. Before that, it was purely advisory. We've also got the Supreme Court. So we need a radical plan to change all this. And getting out of the ECHR, I now think, is unavoidable. It's not impossible, but I don't think it's likely. I think we haven't made that commitment. So I think from a democratic point of view, it should be in our manifesto. And if the manifesto has got to include lots of radical new ideas for the country, and if we do that, we're going to give the people a clear choice. At the moment, it's which centrist, slightly left of centre, slightly right of centre, do we have Keir or Rishi? You know, there needs to be clear divide, a clear choice the British people have to make at the next election. At the moment, it's not clear enough.
At home, over the weekend, I was watching the Sunday morning political chat shows, as you do if you're a political obsessive like you and me. But I was struck by the number of commentators who said that the public don't really care about immigration, that it's a Tory obsession. It's all about the party turning in on itself. What do you say to that?
I think they're completely out of touch with what the average man and woman thinks in this country. Look, London seems to be in a very different place than the bulk of the rest of the country. I'm an Essex MP, although unfortunately we're stuck in Greater London. We'd love to be free of that and be in an autonomous borough, but we're stuck under the Mayor of London. And I know better than most MPs in the Greater London area that my constituents in Romford think very differently than the perceived opinion in inner London. And I just think that people that think that immigration isn't a problem are just so out of touch. We have had colossal increase of immigration in the last 15 years. Every government has promised to tackle immigration, both legal and illegal, but we failed to do it. Every single time we promised, every single time it hasn't happened, people no longer believe us. But we have to control our population and control the immigration into this country. If we don't, we're talking about in the next, I think, next 8 or 10 years, an increase in population the size of Scotland coming in. It's simply unsustainable. And I think that it's also leading to divisions in our society. It's creating cultural divisions. It's feeding into the woke agenda. When people dislike our country and hate our country, use immigration, they weaponize it as a way of dividing us even further. What we need to do is have immigration together with integration. If you integrate and you're part of British society, immigration works. If you divide people up, then it doesn't work. You're setting one group against another, which is what's happening, I'm afraid, in parts of London and in inner city areas in different parts of the country. So we need a firm, strong immigration policy, which we actually implement. It's no good promising these things and then failing to do it. And that is one of the major reasons why so many of our core voters are disillusioned with the Conservative Party and are voting for reform. If we want to actually prevent that from happening, we need an immigration policy which is right for our country, and that means controlling the numbers.
You came into Parliament as MP for Romford in the heyday of Tony Blair, 2001, his second landslide election victory. What do you think of where Labour currently are, Andrew? Obviously, you're going to be campaigning strongly for a Conservative government, but when you talk to people on the doorsteps about the dangers of voting for Labour, what will be your main themes?
I'm very worried. I think people are sleepwalking into allowing the most left-wing Labour government in history the opportunity to seize power. And goodness knows what damage they would do. I mean, Blair's government did enough damage. We've left with a legacy of so many things that he established, such as the Equalities Act, the constitutional reforms he brought in, and so on. Labour under Keir Starmer would be the most left-wing government. The core ministers are hiding away. They're keeping quiet, but they're still there. And I believe that a Labour government would do huge damage to our country. And I think the British people need to wake up. We need to prevent the calamity of a left-wing Labour government taking power from happening. They could be in power for 10 years. I weep in thinking the kind of things they would do. It's the opposite of what I think most British people want. People actually want a right of centre government that looks after the interests of our country, that re-energises the economy, controls the immigration, makes the most of the Brexit opportunities that we have so that we become a strong, prosperous, free nation again. These are the kind of basic things that I think people just are crying out for. The Conservative Party, by not delivering it, by not offering it, people are disillusioned. So a divided right, people voting for reform, but you're simply delivering a Labour government and one that could do huge damage to our country. So I think there needs to be discussions between Nigel Farage and the Conservative Party. I don't think that it would be a very proud legacy for Nigel, who I greatly admire. A lot of people in reform, most of whom are ex-Conservatives, if they hand over power to the most left-wing Labour government in history, I think they too need to rethink their strategy. And I think the Conservative Party needs to rethink our strategy. We've got 6 months to unite the right. have a clear, strong agenda for Britain and prevent the calamity of a left-wing Labour government. That's what I'd like to see happen.
Andrew Rossendale, thanks so much for appearing on Planet Normal.
Thank you.
There you go, Alison. Andrew Rossendale there, a man who knows the Tory backbenches literally like the back of his own hand. He reckons the results were shocking last week, but for now, Sunak's safe.
I should say, I think he's an absolutely perfect Planet Normal guy, really. So much of what he said resonated with me. That's my kind of MP. And I think something you put to him, Liam, was that someone like that, given the state of the Tory party, is sort of somehow depicted as a kind of extremist or far right. And we're hearing a lot of voices, not like Andrew's, essentially saying, oh, we mustn't swivel too far to the right because that would be dangerous. But my case, which Andrew articulates very well, is what's happened is the Tory party has swung so far to the left that what Reform Party voters and others who are staying home are asking for is just, could you budge up a bit towards the centre-right? And I also really appreciated Andrew speaking with such rare honesty. You don't often hear this from the political class, about the long-term damage of lockdown and how basically lockdown has buggered up so much that people are finding frustrating and infuriating about the Tory government.
Indeed, Andrew Rossendale was one of the key anti-lockdown campaigners in Parliament. We, of course, talked a great deal, didn't we, Alison, during lockdown about the work of the COVID recovery group led by Mark Harper, who is now, of course, in the cabinet running the transport brief. It seems to me that Andrew Rossendale and some of the rest of us, for that matter, won't get any credit as the various warnings we gave against lockdown become more and more true in terms of the damage to people's health, the extension of NHS waiting lists, because the NHS was basically shut down during lockdown unless it was tackling COVID. The fact that mental health issues, worklessness have exploded really as big social phenomena now in the UK since lockdown. You wrote a piece, didn't you, in The Telegraph? And put the link in the show notes to this episode, because people like you and me who were anti-lockdown, we didn't discourage people from being vaccinated. We both had the vaccines ourselves, didn't we? And we said so on Planet Normal many times. But because we were brave enough to tackle the fierce pro-lockdown consensus with, of course, the government introducing lockdown and the Labour Party, the SNP and so on, calling for, you know, ever more restrictions to be applied, we were talking about the dangers and we didn't get any thanks for it and we don't get any thanks now.
Just thinking what my grandmother used to say, you'll have your reward in heaven. That's how long we'll have to wait. Yeah, I wrote this piece, Liam, about, you know, I'm not a COVID conspiracy theorist. I was right. And the reason I wrote that was because I was really pretty annoyed because a Times journalist called Janice Turner, she's an excellent journalist, but she wrote a piece where she mentioned, in fact, she was mentioning in a rather flattering way, my first novel, I Don't Know How She Does It, about working mothers. And Janice basically said, oh, Alison used to be great until she swerved into COVID conspiracy theories. And this was about 3 weeks ago. And I literally thought, are you still, with everything we can see around us, are you still going to call me a conspiracy theorist? Because God knows every single day or, you know, every other week now brings some confirmation that stuff that we were accused of being mad and wrongheaded and murderer, I think at some point was one of the accusations. I've had it with that now, really. I mean, we've seen great people like Professor Shanetra Gupta, probably our greatest epidemiologist, world-renowned expert in coronaviruses, who said that the old and the vulnerable must be protected while everyone else got on with their lives. And she was accused of wanting hundreds of thousands of needless deaths. But now, of course, we know that with the excess deaths, we're getting tens of thousands of needless deaths because of the lockdown. So, yeah, I mean, we'll put it in the show notes, but it's worth having a look at. And we should just also mention that this week, AstraZeneca has announced that its COVID vaccine is being withdrawn worldwide. And that follows the pharmaceutical company admitting in court that the jabs have caused various clotting disasters, including obviously terrible side effects and indeed, sadly, deaths.
With any compensation payments indemnified by taxpayers.
So what I did in my piece is I went through the various conspiracy theories of which I was accused, and then I contrasted them with the reality, and it just gives you a kind of grim satisfaction. But I just won't take it anymore, because I think at the time we were just had to sort of take the blows and everything we were accused of. I don't mind that. That was the price that we had to pay for being in that particular trench and fighting that battle. But for people who did nothing, who literally did nothing while dads weren't allowed into the births of their own baby. Absolutely horrendous cruelty and stupidity. And nobody said anything. You know, so few journalists said that really can't be right. So we'll always be proud, won't we, co-pilot, that, you know, we stood up against the insanity, really.
Now on to our listener emails. Your messages sent to planetnormal@telegraph.co.uk. Please keep them coming. We love to read your thoughts, don't we, Alison? We learn so much from the citizens of Planet Normal.
Jennifer says, congratulations on the 200th anniversary of Planet Normal.
We haven't done it yet.
On the upcoming 200th anniversary of Planet Normal. I remember the very first podcast in those frustrating dark days, says Jennifer. And although I won't be able to be with you all in person, I will be in spirit and I will certainly be listening. Thank you, Alison, Liam, all of your guests and the Planet Normal team that put the common sense back into what should be Great Britain. Well, that's lovely. Thanks for those kind words, Jennifer. And everybody who can't be with us in person at the Cadogan Hall will, of course, be able to listen to the special Planet Normal 200th anniversary event on the Thursday, the 30th, as usual.
This is from Jackie. Dear Alison and Liam, I love Planet Normal. It helps remind me that I'm sane and it's the world around me that's going mad. Keep it up. With Sadiq Khan comfortably nestled in for another term as London Mayor, is it time for the outer boroughs of London to return to the home counties? There's no ULEZ out there. Many thanks, Jackie. And this is from Peter in Leeds. I lived in Hare Hills Ward for 10 years until 2010. Back then, there was very little extremism from the Muslim residents. We managed to live together in a reasonable way. Watching what's happened in the local elections has sent a chill down my spine. I regularly drive through Hare Hills to walk my dog at Roundhay Park Lake. I fear for that part of Leeds, says Peter, with Mothin Ali in a position of power and influence. He seems anything but reasonable and, frankly, a dangerous person to have such influence.
Something we should mention, Liam, actually, is the quandary this puts Labour in. The Telegraph's done quite a lot of research into this Muslim group, which has rather really cheekily put 18 orders to Sir Keir Starmer about demands, about the way they want various rules and so on to be changed to benefit the Muslim community. And what the Telegraph has discovered, by the way, is that behind that Muslim proposal are all sorts of extremist radicals. And in the next few months, Liam, I think it'll be very interesting to see how many Labour MPs hold their nerve, including Starmer and Wes Streeting, and how many start to appease this increasingly bellicose and aggressive minority.
This is an important email from David, who is a healthcare practitioner. Dear Alison and Liam, I've listened to every one of your nearly 200 podcasts and look forward to it every week. It was particularly gratifying to hear you speak honestly about COVID vaccine injuries and deaths. I got the impression that the dam finally broke while you were talking and honesty came out. I do hope that you don't regret it and build up the dam again in future podcasts. I've written to you several times regarding this issue, which nobody wants to touch for fear of being labelled an anti-vaxxer, while people suffered and died for lack of knowledge of the relative risks of the virus and the vaccine. Thank you, says David, for having the courage to speak out.
I think people were very glad that we've been talking about this a bit more, Liam. Richard says, I'm a retired European patent attorney with a chemistry degree and a background in patent litigation, including in the field of medical devices. You're absolutely right about COVID, and more to the point, we're absolutely right at the time. The control freaks who dreamed up the regulations were making up the science as they went along. Lockdown was the evil twin of quarantine because it kept the infected in close contact with the susceptible. More power to your elbow, says Richard. Thank you. This is from Jenny. Like so many of your fans, I've been listening to the two of you ever since you began Planet Normal. I just love hearing your banter, or Liam taking the piss out of me, and nonsense. Nonsense?
Warranted.
What nonsense, Jenny? Oh, your banter and nonsense, as well as all the gold nuggets that get dug up during your conversations. It really does make me feel that while there are folk like you around who can reach so many, perhaps our country won't sink into the sea, along with my erstwhile beloved Conservative Party, who I can't help but think is doomed. Entirely its own fault, I have to say, says Jenny. But to echo so many others, she says, do please keep on cheering us up, Planet Normal. That's lovely.
And so that's it from Planet Normal for another week as we leave our sanctuary of sweet reason, our flying refuge of reason views. Email of the week. It's your turn, Alison.
And it's going to Jennifer, who cannot join us at the 200th anniversary event. But I hope, Jennifer, that getting a rare as rocking horse poo Planet Normal mug will make up for that. And raise a mug to us when you're listening to the anniversary podcast.
So send an email, Jennifer, to planetnormal@telegraph.co.uk. And in the subject heading, put mug winner. Give us your postal address and we'll send that Planet Normal mug straight to you.
And finally, another reminder about our upcoming Planet Normal event. We will soon be recording our 200th episode of our Voyage of Right Thinking at a special live event on Wednesday, the 29th of May at Cadogan Hall, which is very close to the Telegraph's headquarters in Victoria, central London, starting at 7 p.m. We've sold a few tickets, haven't we, Halligan?
We certainly have. We're proud to have reached this milestone, Alison. We couldn't have done it without you, our wonderful, wise and loyal Planet Normal listeners. And we'll be joined on Wednesday, the 29th of May, by two fantastic guests, novelist extraordinaire Lionel Shriver and former Tory cabinet minister and Telegraph columnist Lord David Frost.
It's going to be a lovely combination, two of my favourite talkers. And I think Lord Frost may be persuaded to explain to us why he was not allowed to be on the candidates list to be a Conservative MP. A quite extraordinary story.
Do grab your tickets. They're going fast. Well over half the seats in Cadogan Hall have already been sold, but there are still some tickets available for subscribers on the Telegraph's website. Link in the show notes to this episode. Please join us on Wednesday the 29th of May for a special live extended 200th episode of Planet Normal. And as we speed away from our beloved Planet Normal, the madness of Planet Earth comes back into view, thanks as ever to producers Isabel Bouchard, Cass Ho and Louisa Wells. Stay safe and in touch with us and with each other. Until next week, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.